So before moving on and motivating what we are going to do today, maybe I would like to still insist on 2 points that we did before, because I was told that there were some confusions in the tutorial. I don't know if those confusions persist, if I should revisit them. So is everyone happy with the path order exponential? Are you? You had complaints about matrices commuting and not commuting. Very good. What did we do? Okay, so on the path integral, but do you agree, once I tell you that the path order exponential is defined as multiplying many matrices in some order, then yesterday, I don't know if you had time to see the lecture, we showed that from that definition, it follows that that definition is indeed different from the usual definition of the exponential. It obeys different differential equation. When we wrote it as some integrals, there were some nested integrals and so on, so... The final step.
What I always say is that if you set epsilon to zero, I think it should be the same.
No, okay, so that step I don't want to review because I did it in the beginning of the last lecture. So what I want to do is to... I think some people were confused why, when we first discretized, why at that point were we not worried with the fact that matrices commute or not commute. So let me just remind you that there is no... So in the path integral derivation... So those who are not confused, don't worry about this. So you have exponential of minus t times some operator, O. Okay? This operator was second derivative, and then it was second derivative plus some gauge field, and so on. So what is this? What is this O? This O is some big matrix. Right? It's some big matrix. What are the vectors? The vectors, they have... For example, space-time, I can consider cats in space-time. But then, because the operator itself it contains the gauge field, there is also some color index, A. So these are the vectors which act on this matrix. Okay? So if I have this operator O, if I sandwich with some x1 and x2, and if then I extract component AB, this is a number. Okay? Now, if this is just a big matrix, then e to the minus t times the matrix is equal to e to the minus t over 2 times the matrix, e to the minus t over 2 times the matrix. Just a big matrix. Of course, it commutes with itself. It's one operator. It's equal. There's no approximation, and I'm breaking it in half. And of course, this is equal also to e to the minus epsilon times operator, tac, 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 e to the minus epsilon times operator. No approximate sign, just equals, just an operator. Just some big matrix. It doesn't. Even if it does, it's just a big matrix which acts on some cats. What you are saying is not diagonal. Okay, that's a matrix. I can choose as my basis position space and color. And this is a matrix in this space. It is just not, it acts on this Hilbert space. It's not diagonal. Okay, if it depends on P and X, it's not diagonal. Okay, who cares? But it's just a matrix. What did we do next? Next, we started inserting here, in the middle of this exponential, we started inserting integral dxi, xi, xi. And then, what was before e to the minus epsilon o became xi, e to the minus epsilon O X I plus 1. This is still a matrix, but now a matrix, not a big matrix. This is, if you want, a small matrix. M, which has only color indices now, A and B, because I already conjugated with position XI and XI plus 1. And now two such matrices, and then what we got after doing this, then... we got a product of such matrices, M, M. And now the different M's don't commute, because these different M's, for different xi and xi plus 1, they are just different matrices. So because I'm integrating here this integral over all the dxi. So for different dxi, this matrix is not the same as this one, and they don't commute. So in the derivation, no ambiguity. Just an operator, which acts on this big space, And of course, when it's an operator, I can just the operator. It's a big matrix. E to the matrix is E to the matrix over 2 times E to the matrix over 2, and so on. When I start inserting identities, I get a product of a bunch of matrices. And when I integrate over DXI, for different DXIs, I have different matrices, and they don't commit. So there are no double standards in the derivation. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Yes.
How would you do that with operation operators on that small matrix?
On this one? Yes. Are you saying that this is not a number? This is a number.
Is that to be a number, but the way that you do it, like you said, that when I apply the momentum, the space part to the potential, get the phase with the potential. And to get rid of the part that has the
I would have to expand and do it carefully and taking care of the epsilons. This part I would do. You are saying, how do I convert this into a number?
Yeah.
Typically, the best way is, okay, I expand this, then I, when everything is down, I have some stuff which depends on momentum, some stuff which depends on position, then
it's useful to put some momentum stuff. But that's just a technical thing. I don't want to discuss that. That's just something technical. You do it, I mean, it's obvious that this is a matrix in AB. How do you compute this matrix? Okay, you put some bases of P to integrate and to compute it more simply. You don't need to. You can, of course, just, you know how operators P act on position space, just compute this. Discretize if you want and compute it. Whatever. Okay? But just don't think that in the original derivation, when I discretized, that there was any ambiguity and anything that I was saying, they don't commute, they commute, and so on. No, it was just an operator and... It was the same operator. It's when we start doing the path integral that we get different matrices because of the completeness. Okay? So I hope that clarifies a bit. So, good. So that was just some comments so that you can be a bit happier, I hope. So the second comment I would like to do is about, I want to tell you that there exists, when you integrate over group elements, this is just preparation for what I'm going to do because I don't want to, when I will start, we will need this measure, but I don't want to introduce it later, so let me remind you of something. Have you heard of the Haar measure during these lectures? Yes? Sorry? Ah, I did, okay. Someone else did? I don't remember what I told you. Okay, so, to integrate over groups, there exists a nice measure, which is called the Haar measure. So let me tell you what it is in general. So you have some group element G, okay? This belongs to some group, and say G is parametrized by something like theta, phi, psi. This would be, for example, for residue. Okay? It's some parameters. Then you compute that then this R measure, du, can be computed by taking the trace of d g minus 1 dg, if you want definition. What is nice about this definition? Okay? What's nice about this definition? First, let's see that it is something sensible for SU2. So for SU2, this g of theta, phi, and psi, we saw that we could parameterize it by Euler angles, and it was just e to the I over some angles, psi over 2, sigma z, e to the I, theta over 2, sigma x, e to the I, phi over 2, sigma z. So this is a matrix. And if you compute this trace of du du minus 1, you see that this measure, this, what this defines, it defines a line element in the group manifold. So the group defines a manifold, and we want to define a line element in this manifold to tell us how two elements of the group differ by each other. So this is the definition of the line element in this group manifold, ds squared.
Okay? And for SU2, I want to put a 1 hour. Then, if you do this, then you compute this ds squared is just d theta squared plus d psi squared plus d phi squared, plus d psi squared plus 2 cosine of 2 theta d phi d psi. And this is good, because this is nothing but the metric for the sphere, it's one nice, it's one micro metric for the sphere S3. And our claim that we saw in the beginning was that indeed SU2 was the same as S3. Okay, good. So what is nice about this matrix in general, not only for SU2? What is nice about this matrix is that you see that the way about this line element is that this line element is invariant under global left and right rotations. So if you do G, goes to some matrix U times G times V, where these are unitary matrices, this is like, where these are matrices, this is like invariant. Because it's clear, right? DG, G minus 1 becomes D minus 1. When you put it there, you see that it's invariant. Okay? Is it clear? That it's less invariant? G minus 1 is just U. V minus 1, G minus 1, U minus 1, it cancels with the U. And do that something. Okay. So this is, of course, something that we want in our group. If we just, it's like choosing another origin. We just apply a transformation, rotate all G's by something, and we want our line element to be the same. From this line element, this is like some G mu nu dx nu dx nu. Okay? You can construct now the Haar measure du. This is the Haar measure, In the usual way, when you have some group elements, square root of g, the determinant of the line element, d phi, d psi, d theta, which in this case is proportional to, this is what we usually do, to, so integrating over the group element, du, is equal to some integral d theta, d phi, d psi, if you compute this determinant, sine of theta over, this is just some convention, 8 pi squared times dot dot dot. Okay? Where the integral, this is theta, theta goes from 0 to pi, the other one from 0 to 2 pi. That's a canonical way of integrating over group elements. Okay. Just construct a line element, which is the natural line element which is invariant on the left and right rotations. From this line element, we have some metric which tells us how points are separated, and then we proceed in the usual way to construct an integration just by the volume part, the square root of the determinant of the metric, times the,
and then we integrate the coordinates.
This is the same du that we used when we were doing some. At some point, I had some. If you look at the notes, this du is the same that appeared in the Fadev-Popov derivation. We used some Fadev-Popov stuff that we did before. This is product is normalized so that the integral du is equal to 1, which was something that we used indeed in our matrix model derivation, if we go and see. Okay, good. Okay. So, this was just so that you keep in mind that such thing exists. I'm going to use the Haar measure for SUN. At that point, I'm only going to tell you some properties of the Haar measure without defining it explicitly for SUN. But I just want to show you that for particular groups, it's very explicit how you construct it. You just parameterize it, compute the spline elements, pick the determinant of the metric. There is a canonical way of constructing it. It's nothing very fancy. Here it is how you do it for SU2. But for other groups, you imagine doing it in the same way. So we saw that in QED, if we compute the Wilson loop for any contour, okay, this will be equal to 1 plus the exchange of a gluon between two points, then we have the exchange of gluons between different points, and because the theory is free, it just exponentiates, and this becomes just the exponential of the integral of the gluon where we integrate over this point and this point. Okay? This was exact in QED. So when we normalized it, there was some E squared here, some charge, and this is the final result. And we saw that this was equal for... Okay, and we saw that the Wilson loop in QED for the rectangular shape, which was the one which, as we saw, was given, was related to the interaction between two, an electron and an anti-electron, was given by e to the minus t. Then there was some self-energy, I don't remember by heart, but something like this, no? Minus e squared, then there was some Coulomb energy.
Was it this? Yeah, with a 40.
R. And this was some self-energy. And this was just a Coulomb potential. Okay, very good. Okay, cool. So this was what we did last time. Any questions? Yes.
Well, why is it pi squared again? It's e squared over 4 pi squared r. Why isn't this 4 pi r?
Maybe it's 4 pi r. I don't remember. In my notes, I have 4 pi squared. I don't know. You mean about this pi here?
Yeah.
Last time, the confusion was serious. I mean, pi, who cares? Last time, the confusion, if you remember, was about an r.
Yeah.
Well, that I can. I accept criticisms about pi. I mean, who cares? Factors of r.
Okay, that's good. I mean, pi, I mean, maybe. I don't know. Who cares? Yeah, that's possible. Good. So... it's a good exercise to just compute that integral and see if there's a pi or not. But I suspect it must be okay, as it was before. But okay.
I can. Yeah, probably there is a pi
squared. So, what about QCD? Or rather, just pure glue. So, the action is just the trace of the integral of s squared, okay? But now f is, now f mu nu is d nu a nu minus d nu a nu plus the a nu a nu. So we're not free, so of course we have this, so it's not free anymore. So what we get for the Wilson loop? Okay, good. So one way to do it is just to remind what was the definition that we wrote. We wrote that it was 1, this part of the exponential, what was it defined? 1 plus integral around the cycle. So what we want is to get the average of what I'm going to write. 1 plus integral of, let me use this notation that we introduced last time, m of t dt. Okay, so m of t is a mu of x of t dot x dot mu of t. Plus m of t dt. So let's say this contour integral is integral from some parameter 0 to some parameter t dt. We parameterize it from 0 to capital T. Plus, and then we have the integral dt1 integral dt2, and t1 went from 0 to t, and t2 needed to be bigger that q1, so it went from q1 up to t, of m of q1, m of t2. Plus dot dot dot. Okay. And then we could just now compute these averages doing final items. Okay. So then the average of n is 0, the average of n times n is a propagator, the average of 3m's we need to compute. 3m is 0 again, 4m's we have to do more weak contraction and just compute it using final items. Okay? Of course, we can also just do it graphically and just immediately write down what the answer is using pictures, just using final diagrams. After all, that's what we are doing here in a more pedestrian way. So what do we have for the Wilson loop for the general contour? We have that this is given by first a Gluon, okay, 1 plus a Gluon exchange. Okay, what would be the next term that you would write? So let me put some e, some g squared here. What is the next one? So this one came from the average of m of t1, m of t. This one would come from the average of 4m's, for example. Or 3m's, here it was. Yes?
Is that like three gluon
lines? Absolutely.
Now, the gluons are not free, so they interact. So we have a vertex, and we can have three gluons just interacting. So we use the vertex that we get from this commutator times the derivative of A, that gives a cubic vertex, and we can start having this stuff. Plus, then, other kind of diagrams that we have. We have, for example, this line, and another gluon like this. Okay? If I would keep track of all the G's, because here I have one vertex, you get extra G's. This is correct, even though I'm not being careful explaining the powers of G. But these diagrams are G squared. All these diagrams that I'm drawing now are G4. But just to see it, sometimes you have more propagators, sometimes more vertices. If you work out the G's, you see that it's okay. Then you have this diagram. Then you would say, okay, what about also this diagram, where I have this gluon, and this gluon goes here. So sometimes we can ignore this diagram. When? When n is large. So if I'm thinking of QCD, if I'm thinking of these matrices here as n times n, right, when n goes to infinity, we should keep planar graphs only, as we saw in the beginning. Okay? So this one we could drop. This is down by 1 over n. But this means that even if I ignore interactions, even if I ignore interactions in the bulk, okay, even if I would ignore all diagrams which have vertices in the bulk, the result will not be just exponential of the one loop result. Because you see that this guy is not just this one square. Because this guy has this constraint that these points cannot pass through each other. So if I would write explicitly the integrations, I would not allow T1 to go through T2 and so on. Okay? So even ignoring all these vertices, what we get is not just the exponential of the one loop result. Okay? So, okay, I'm not going to tell you anything that is going to shock you, but this is, it's hard. Okay. I have many Feynman diagrams with vertices and so on. Okay. Big surprise. Okay, good. So, still, I mean, it's a nice exercise. If you want, go ahead and do it. To, for example, see what is the generalization. Now you have to compute the analog of the Coulomb potential perturbatively. Right? So if you are working, if G is very small, you can keep only this graph. Then it's the same as before. I mean, it's the same computation as QED, just the gluon. But next, you have to take into account these two graphs, and this will correct the potential between the two now quarks. And you could now perturbatively start studying what would be the correction now to the V of R. Okay? You would have now to do, for V of R, we will now have the two straight lines, and now we also have to draw diagrams like this, and diagrams like this, which would correct the computation at, so they give order G to the 4 corrections to our potential V of R. Okay, good. So this is a way of doing it. Sure. Like this? No, absolutely. I'm saying that because I have this, and because I don't distinguish in QED between this and this, in QED this is the same thing. Doesn't matter because crossing or not crossing is the same. I don't care about their crossing or not. Now I do care because these guys are separated by 1 over n now because it's an unplanar. No, last time there were not matrices. There was no notion of planar or not planar. So let's fatten this diagram. What is this diagram here in the fat line notation? So let's draw this. So then we have the double line. Then we have a gluon. Right? This is this diagram. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4. This is n to the 4. But this one is not this one. Okay. Okay. If you count powers of n, this is less. How many loops do we have? One on the outside, and in the inside, I think only one. Let's see. One. Yeah, n squared. So this guy would be suppressed. Okay, good. So it is not true that this guy, actually, we can do this exercise of seeing what diagrams would you draw in QCD. So in QED, it is a bit stupid to draw omega. We should draw instead log of omega, because the theory is free. So we don't want to count diagrams which are just the square of the one-loop diagram. And in that case, for log of this guy, we will draw that the result is just this. And that's it. Done. What would be the diagrams for QCD, for this pure glue, for this log of the Wilson loop? Okay? Or let me write it in a way. Wilson loop is equal to exponential of something. What is this something? Okay. It must agree with the one loop, right? It must agree with the one loop. So the starting point is also the same thing. Okay? But now, if I expand this, plus, let's see what we need to put here. Now, if I expand this, this is equal to 1 plus g squared times this. Okay, great. But then there is plus g4 over 2 times this graph square. Right? But we don't want this graph square. We only want this one. What's the difference between this one and this one square? It's the cross terms. So what we would write here is we have to subtract minus the cross terms. Okay? With some g to the 4. Plus some g to the 4 times the interactions, those are not contained at all, plus tac, tac, tac. And there is an interesting technology, an interesting way of thinking, how do you exponentiate these non-abelian theories, the theories which are not free? And you get these diagrams where they become crossed, and you need to cross them, and so on. And all this stuff, there is a huge literature on this. It's called non-abelian exponentiation. And I think you can ask Tian Hang for details. I think she studied it, so she probably knows everything about this. But again, it's still hard. It's still hard. I mean, it's simpler than just computing W, but it's still tough to sum all these diagrams. Okay, so what I'm going to propose is let's try to find an approach where instead of doing it perturbatively, let's try to take the coupling large. Let's try, can we study, instead of studying perturbatively, let's try to take G to infinity. Consider large G instead of perturbative G. This is mine, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. So we want to understand, to try to understand, strongly coupled non-abelian gauge theories. Let me put the non between brackets, because what I'm going to say, I mean, non-abelian is not really important. Do you remember in statistical mechanics what is the typical trick for doing strong coupling expansions? What typically happens? Okay, this is a very broad question, but say in the Heising model or something like this. It's very useful to use this language of loops and plaquettes and so on, and we are going to try to do something inspired by that. Namely, we are going to consider lattice QCD, to try to put QCD on a lattice. And then on the lattice, the strong coupling expansion will be much more natural. Okay? So the idea, which if you want is inspired by usual statistical mechanics, is discretized spacetime. Maybe before continuing, I should really ask if there are any questions, because now, for the rest of the lecture today, it will be completely different from everything we have done so far. So if there are any questions on this blackboard, it would be nice to ask now.
Is there any reason why you didn't draw energy corrections for the gluons?
No, just there are dots and dots. Yes, you are absolutely right. But there are also self-energy corrections that the same will order, yeah. This diagram is also there, and they should be here as well. Any other questions? I think if you have any questions while I draw a cube, which is something hard for me. I should say that I'm not by any means a specialist on lattice QCD. I never did anything on this. I just learned basically. I don't know much more than what I'm going to tell them. Just something fun. But it's quite cute. I do want to learn more at some point. Okay, this is our space time. With some less spacing A. And we will try to define our gauge theory as a theory on this super lattice, hyper lattice. So we want to define a statistical model which I define on this hyper lattice, which when the lattice spacing goes to zero, goes to QCD. Any question? Yes, good.
So you always use a cubic lattice, huh?
Yes. Yeah. It's not really important, as usual. We are going to study large distance effects, I mean, all lattices will be in the same universality class. Right. I mean, if the continuum limit exists, it will not matter. Now, that's a very good question. Does the continuum limit exist? Is it okay? Is the theory that we would underline the same as the theory in the continuum limit? That's not an academic question. It's an important one. And we will see that sometimes it doesn't. More questions? So let's consider a face. Let's look at one particular face of one of these cubes. Okay, there is some point here. Well, let's say this is the point x. This, let me call this epsilon 1, this small vector. This small vector epsilon 2. Okay. And let me think for a second. And I think I'm using the conventions that this direction is x2, this direction is x1. Let me write on my notes, see if this is okay. And I want to define, so this is what is called a plaquette. And I want to define a small Wilson loop, which depends on this plaquette, to be defined exactly as the Wilson loop going around this small square. So what is it? It's trace e to the minus I g a. Let me write it and then we will see that it makes sense, hopefully. Just the product of four small Wilson loops around the different edges. So I believe that in the way I did it, I start from this point and go over this. So let's see if this is correct. So A1. No, this doesn't look good to me. A2 epsilon 1, here that should be epsilon 2 here. Okay, this is dangerous. Yeah, supposedly I should have done it wrong. Okay, so let's see what am I doing. I'm saying that the A is evaluated at x minus epsilon 2. So if x is the middle, I'm saying that A is here, in the middle of this edge, which is okay. And then what is the vector which A contracts? It's a vector along E1. And that's why it's multiplied by A, and the component is the component 1. Then the next guy here, it's at position x plus epsilon 1 over 2. Let's see, x plus epsilon 1 over 2 indeed. And the component is component 2, because now it's going up. Then the next one, it's x plus epsilon 2 over 2. Again, here, x plus epsilon 2 over 2, component 1, and then x minus epsilon 1 over 1, which is this, and the other component. Okay? So this is indeed this Wilson loop. Now, if you compute, if you now expand these A's, you see that this is approximately equal. And let me put here as an exercise to check this. Because I'm not 100% confident about the signs. Maybe some signs here are flipped. But you can fix them so that this becomes the small Wilson loop. And then in the continuum limit, this is just trace e to the I, g. You see that you expand these guys, and then what you get is the following. A square d1 a2 minus d2 a1 minus ig commutator of a1 with a2.
at position x, which is nothing, of course. All this, it's just a field strength F1. Yes. I wrote the four different exponentials because I'm writing this Wilson loop around this square, and there are these four segments. So I start this segment, then this segment, then this segment, then this segment. So I just... I shouldn't write it as one exponential because they don't commute. So if you expand and start saying so, you will get that this is equivalent to this, where I have to say the commutator of A1 and A2 and so on. They are matrices. Yes, probably the first signs are wrong because sometimes they go up, sometimes they go down. So the last two guys, they are going to the left and down. So probably I don't trust these signs here. Probably they are plus, those signs, because they are going backwards. Yeah, I mean, it's of course, it's this must be wrong, these signs. Well, let's flip these two. This sounds good. If someone can check quickly, it will be nice. Now, we define omega minus plaquet to be the conjugate of omega plaquet. So basically, you flip that I to a minus I. So that if you consider omega plaquet plus omega dagger or minus plaquette, whatever, omega dagger plaquette, this is equal when you expand in A to 2 times n. So you expand, you get 1 plus something. The 1, the trace gives n. You sum two of these, you get 2 times n minus g square A to the 4 trace of F12 square at position x. And so the proposal, which is at a constant plus what we want, the proposal is to consider the action for Young Mills to be minus 1 over 2 g square sum over all the plaquettes. Okay, so this is both orientations. So we sum over the plaquettes with plus and minus signs. Both orientations. Omega plaquette. Okay. So if you want, this is motivation for this proposal. Once you have the proposal, you can forget about the motivation. But it's something that in the continuum limit looks like it might work. Okay? Notice that this A to the 4, it's nice because when you sum over all the plaquettes, if you have A, you have A to the 4, the sum over all plaquettes becomes exactly a D4X. It's what you need to get a four-dimensional volume integral. You want exactly this A to the 4. Okay, good. So let's try then to consider this statistical field theory, where you integrate over these plaquettes. Let's define some measure to sum over these plaquettes and try to see what is the behavior of this statistical theory. I will do it up here. Okay, so to formalize it a bit, a plaquette, it's not only in the space 1, 2. I mean, we have all these cubes, many faces. So it will be parameterized by, there will be a square, okay, with some corners, I, J, K, L. And this is just the trace of a product of four matrices, right, because it was these four segments. And these four matrices, let's call them U, I, L, U, L, K, U, K, J, U, J, I. No sum, I mean, it's just product of matrices, where this is a unitary n by n matrix. The goal is to forget about the original definition and work with these matrices. And what do we have? We have, for example, that U dagger ij, a matrix is associated to a link, is equal to U j I, which is equal also to u I j minus 1. Okay. So in particular, let me, these guys are compact. Okay? It's compact. It's a matrix of SUN, or like SU2, SU3, some compact manifold. Yes. Okay? And what we will do is we will integrate over this possible use. And what measure will we use? The Haar measure. It's the measure to integrate over groups and so on. Okay? That's, after all, why I was introducing it in the beginning. But I did not want now to spend time going over that mathematical detail. Sure.
In the loop in the bucket,
yeah.
Should it be like A1 evaluated at x minus x11?
Let's see. Here, which line are you thinking? Which of the four?
For example, bottom one.
This one?
Yes.
It should be, let me know. So it should be A, lock in the position, x minus x12 over 2, right?
Oh, okay.
And what is the component?
One. Okay, that's confused.
Let's see. Yeah, this looks good. Okay. Okay, great. So our proposal is to consider the following model. Well, I have some integral du. What is this du? It's the product over all possible wings, all wings, ij, du, ij. And what is this du? This du is the Haar measure. It's the way I integrate over unitary matrix. E to the minus that action Young-Mills that we defined there. So all we need to know about the Haar measure are some useful properties of this Haar measure. Let me just write them. You can work them out explicitly. du uij equal to 0. Integral du uij ukl equal to 0. Integral du. Can you write, Faraday? Can you read? I think I will only need this last one. I think. Let's see. This orthogonality condition. Okay? So if I have uij times ukl, I need them to be sorry? So each u is associated to a link. Okay? Each u is related to a link, right? So ij are the linkings, the index between I and j. Now, makes sense. Good. So this is going to be the only one. And strictly speaking, this is what you get when you have SU n with n bigger than 3, otherwise there are some factors of 2, but don't worry about that. Okay, good. So what are the natural observables in this model? What are the kind of averages that we want to compute? What kind of, it's different from the usual field theory, where the thing that comes to mind is a local operator and computing averages. But here, what are the building blocks? They are these links, exponential of the gauge field between a link and another. So what is the natural quantity to consider? It's to multiply several of those links and make loops. So the natural quantities to consider in this approach are exactly loops. So these are the most natural observables that I can try to compute with this statistical model.
So a Wilson loop, which depends on a contour, would be a trace of a product of U's, okay, which are connected. So I have my, the U's would be connected in some path. Okay. This is all in the plane, right? How do I draw if I want them to go in another direction, like this? This works? No. Now they are going down. Now they are in the plane again. Now they are going up. Now they are in the plane again. Just to emphasize that there's nothing about dimension dispersion. Okay. Do you understand what I'm doing? It's a loop that goes in the plane, then goes down for a bit, and so on. Yeah? So on each of these guys, this is I, J, this is some U, I, J. I just make a product of this, and this is our Wilson loop. Okay, good. So averages of this Wilson loop are given by the integral over all these links e to the minus 1 over 2 g square sum over omega of these plaquettes times the Wilson loop here over the same thing without Wilson loop. Now you see that in this model, the easy expansion to do is not small g, it's large g. When g is large, this exponential is very small, I can expand it, as usual in statistical theory, when you do this kind of expansions. So then, when g is... So when g goes to infinity, we bring down exponents. Okay? So we need to compute. So we just need to compute averages like some integral with some du, du, and then a bunch of u's with indices contracted. Okay? Some u's coming from the observable, some u's coming from the definition of the W plaquettes. Okay? Now let's draw a picture. Let's consider, say, maybe I can even draw it here. Yeah, well, let's draw it here. Can I draw it here? So I have these two guys, this u, and this u. I have this stuff. Okay? Now I want to claim that when I bring down the plaquettes, I want to claim that I need this plaquette here. So my claim is that we need this one. We need to bring down this plaquette which shares these two edges with this guy. Why? Because otherwise, when we will integrate, we will get a zero result. So we need to use this orthogonality, to bring down a plaquette, which will be shared to these lines I and J, but in the opposite direction. Yes?
By bringing down, I just mean that you expand. So you just write this as 1 plus minus 1 over 2 g squared sum of omegas plus... Okay? Now you have many terms here, and I claim that you need to go very far away and take a huge one. Why? Because, for example, you need to find this plaquette here. Otherwise, by orthogonality, you need zero. Okay? Because whenever you find this edge, ij, you need to find the conjugate edge going in the other direction. Because otherwise, when you integrate over the links, you will get zero. But now you added this plaquette. Now that you added this plaquette, you add the extra link, so now you need this one. Okay, this one is obvious. This one you needed also because of the boundary. So this one we also need. But now that we add it, okay. This one we also need. So we need this block S because of orthogonality. Because otherwise we'll get a zero result. This is very important.
But then as you are going, for example, now you also need this one.
Because you added these two edges here. Okay? And so on. So we see that what we have to do is we bring down as many plaquettes as we need to cover a surface. Right? So we bring down as many plaquettes as we need to cover a complete surface. Yes. Please tell me what is not clear.
So whenever I bring down a plaquette, I get a product of four U's, right? So I need to, if I have a plaquette going like this, I need to bring down a plaquette which does this, right? And then this link here, the integration over this link here, gives 1 over n. Otherwise, if I would not add this plaquette, if I would integrate over this link, I would get 0 because of this. So I need, whenever I find a uij, I need to have a u going in the opposite direction with the same indices, I and j. Otherwise, I get 0. Yes? So you see, if I draw a contour, I have this guy here. Now I just integrate. Suppose I don't expand. I replace this exponential by 1. And I do the integral. I get 0. Because each plaquette appears only once, and when I integrate over it, I get 0. Yes? So whenever I find a u here, I better put a plaquette here, which goes in the opposite, if this goes in this direction, which goes in this direction. Then this link no longer gives 0. This one no longer gives 0. But this one, these two give 0. So I need another plaquette. And so on. And I see that I need to fill my surface with plaquettes. Okay? So there is a minimal number of plaquettes that I need. There is this surface. So what I get is, so the conclusion we need a surface with A over A squared plaquettes. What is A? A is the area of the surface. So if I divide by the area of each plaquette, I get the number of plaquettes. We need a surface with this many plaquettes, which is bounded by the curve. So if you have some curve, let me now see that I'm looking at it from very far away. It looks like a smooth curve. I need a surface of plaquettes, which is bounded by this surface. So let's call this surface sigma. This would be sigma, and this would be my curve. Yes?
W's.
Yes.
Won't you severely overcount? Won't you severely overcount the surface? Like you'll have those plaquettes many times.
This will not contribute at all. It only has four plaquettes. I need many, many plaquettes. This doesn't contribute at all. Then at some point I find some omega to a very big power, which contributes for the first time. Right? So I don't overcount until I reach a certain number of plaquettes, the minimum that I need to fill this. They never count. They start counting when I brought down enough. And then when I bring even more, they still count, but they give surfaces with more area. Right? So each surface, so what we see, let me write the result, I think it will be clear. Each omega will contribute 1 over n. Okay, powers of n, I was not very careful with counting, but when we integrate, there are powers of n, there are traces, and so on. If you work out the powers of n, this is what it is. If you want, I leave as exercise to work out this n. But this is not important. Forget the n. 1 over g squared times a over a squared. Okay? So we get that whenever I bring down a plaquette, I get a power of g squared. Right? Whenever I bring down a plaquette. So if I need to use n plaquettes, I get 1 over g squared to the power n. That's it. Just that. So what I get is 1 over g squared to the power number of plaquettes. Okay? And of course, this is dominated by the minimal surface. So if I have several surfaces which end on my contour, of course, the one which uses less area is the one that dominates.
So we find this beautiful geometrical meaning that you give me a complicated loop, and what this analysis tells me is, okay, here is my complicated loop, find the minimal area which ends on this loop, like a soap film, I mean, put it in soap, remove it, and you will see some area. This is, I mean, you can do it with soap, you can do experimental physics. So put the loop into soap, remove it, see the surface, compute that area, that gives the result of the Wilson loop. Okay? So this is how you do it in the bus. Very good. Okay, so what do you suggest as an application of all this? What should we do now with this? What is the only Wilson loop that you know that has some nice interpretation? What were we doing yesterday? What Wilson loop did we see that yesterday had a nice physical meaning? Not a particular shape, crazy shape like that. Which shape were we interested in, for example? That had a very clear physical meaning. Yeah, a rectangle. Okay, so let's see what a rectangle gives. So let's compute omega for a rectangle. This should be e to the minus t times v of r. So what is v of r? What is v of r? Okay, very simple. What is the minimal area for the rectangle? What is the area of a rectangle? Can I pick someone at random? Yes. What is the area of a rectangle? Very good, very good. This one was tricky. So indeed, if you have some big T and some big R, from what we computed, we got that this is e to the minus, let me write that as an exponential, e to the minus the area, which is t. Okay, well, let's write what that is. That is, that told me that it's 1 over n g squared to the power of the area, which is t times r over the lattice spacing, which is a squared. In other words, this is e to the minus t v of r, where v of r is equal to r times, let me call this, sorry for introducing so much notation, but this is important, times k, sorry, r times k, where k is a constant. What is this constant? K, let's see, I have the log 1 over a squared, so k is 1 over a squared log of n g squared. This, by the way, is called the area law. Okay, so what is the interpretation of this result? How do you interpret this result? This V of R being linear in R? Yes?
The potential between two quarks.
Absolutely, the potential between two quarks.
Right.
Yeah, so it's linear in R, so it means that there is a force, a constant force between the quarks, and this is, if you want, evidence for confinement. Okay, so recall that in QED our computation was 1 over R, Coulomb potential, and now we get linear in R. Yes? We did not.
Was that in the rules?
No. Very good question. Very good. Okay, very good. I'll get back to that point 5 minutes afterwards. But that is excellent. But let me first continue. So what is then this k? What's the physical meaning of this k? Which is a dimensionful quantity. So it's 1 over a square times log of some coupling stuff. This is, if you want, this is what is called the string tension, the tension between these quarks. Okay? And you can measure it experimentally, and this k, which as I mentioned, one of the length, this k is of order 400 mev squared. Okay, something that you measure, and you know, it's 400 MeV for you to hit. Okay, very good. Now let's start seeing if any of this makes any sense, because I mean, we described some statistical model. Is this really UCD? Is this completely self-consistent? Does it really make sense what we did? Okay? And we will not be completely happy with the answer, but it makes some sense. It gives us a result that we like. In QCD, we know that there is confinement. But, as Sebastian pointed, nothing special I said about was really, really tied to QCD. And in QED, we know this is wrong. We know that in QED, the potential is 1 over R. Come on, it's not R. So this is not a strong coupling behavior of QED. In QED, we compute this exactly. There was no approximation, and it was Coulomb. So what the hell are we doing? In QED, this is wrong. Okay? So, okay, good. So let's think. So K, as I said, is a physical quantity. It's measured. You can measure it. This tension. Okay. On the contrary, A and G are not. Right? So A is a cutoff that you use to define your discretization. In principle, you should be able to take it as small as you want. And G is a coupling. It's not something measurable. Sorry, what you measure is K. Okay? This is important. To keep in mind what is physical and what is not physical. So we saw that K was equal to 1 over A squared log of G squared N. Okay? And so we want to compute our Wilson loop. It's a rectangle, but okay, let me draw it as some shape. And what we would like is for our picture to be to have these plaquettes here, very small plaquettes. This is what would happen in an ideal world, right? Here would be our plaquettes. But, so this would be ideal. But our approximation assumed G going to infinity, or at least G large. What does it mean exactly? No one knows. I mean, what is exactly G large? When is it a good approximation? This is not an easy question. But if G is large, then how to keep K fixed when G is much bigger than 1. Okay, here let me, of course, write that, I mean, what we mean by K, which is dimensionful to be fixed, we mean, say, K times distance square, K times R. I mean, say, K is dimension 1 over A square. When I say fixed, I mean pick K multiplied by the distance of the quarks to make something dimensionful. Okay. If you want, I can write this equation the following way. K times R square is equal to R square over A square log of G square N. And when I say keep K fixed, I mean keep this dimensionful dimensionless quantity fixed, okay, to do proper things. But for the purpose of the discussion, it's easier if I think, let's keep K fixed and see what happens. But now you see what happens. If you want to keep this K fixed, 400 MeV, that's what you measure, and this G becomes huge, A must become very large. So you wanted to study this, but in fact, what we got was here is our Wilson loop, here is our plaquette. This is not so good. We don't want to describe loops by a plaquette which is much bigger than the loops. Okay? So this is disappointing. So we need to lower the size of this plaquette. We need to decrease G. When we start decreasing G, we start decreasing the size of our plaquette, and our goal is to see if we can get to some size of plaquettes which is inside the loop, for which this approximation makes sense. But if we start reducing G, then our approximation might not be good enough. Okay? Because our approximation assumed that she is large. Okay? So how can we... So what exactly do we want to understand? So we need to decrease this so that A also decreases. Okay, but then... Okay, our K of G, when G is very large, is given by that, but we don't know exactly what happens to K of G when G continues to decrease. So K of G... okay, we don't know how K of G behaves as we decrease G. For example, let's consider two very different scenarios. One scenario is, okay, you start decreasing G and this K vanishes at some G. Okay? So, for example, scenario, possible scenarios. K of G as becomes zero for G smaller than some G critical. Scenario two. K of G bigger than zero always. Scenario one, scenario two would mean that, okay, K would change. We would have to decrease G until a point where we can trust where we have a good continuum limit. But okay, K would be positive. The conclusion would hold. The conclusion that we have some potential which is linear. If, on the other hand, there is a phase transition, it just means that the theory that I defined in the lattice is not, in the continuum limit, the theory that I wanted to describe. I define some theory on a lattice. As I take G lower and lower, there is a phase transition, and I go to the continuum limit, of course, but there is a phase transition, and I get something else. And, indeed, what we computed is okay, but this happens, for example, for QED. For sure. For sure it happens because we know that this is the exact result in QED. We know that we don't have a term linear in K. So as we decrease K, we go to a phase transition, this string tension goes to zero, and we have the confinement, and we get 1 over R potential. K of G bigger than zero always is what happens in QCD. And here I should put probably because it's not completely settled, but given that we measure it experimentally, it's probably correct. Mathematically, we cannot prove it rigorously. Okay, very good. So then we might think, okay, so if we want to decrease G, if it seems that at large G we don't have this good continuum limit, could it be that we should look for the continuum limit when G is very small? Right? So could it be that there is a limit where G is very small, A is very small, but we can form some K, some string tension which is finite in this limit? Because here we cannot, right? When G goes to infinity, A goes to zero, we are not converging to some K which we can keep fixed. Okay? So all this motivates us to study this string tension K of G at weak coupling. Now, this looks tough, but it's very simple. Looks tough, I told you it was hard. But now that we have some intuition, now that we know the dimensions of K, it's easy. The hard part was to know that it is 1 over A squared, which is, of course, obvious, but the claim is that was roughly the hard part. Okay, so I want to know if there is any question on this. I know this is slightly subtle, so do you have any conceptual question, any question about this? Yes.
So, is it something you obtain from the
Yeah, to study at weak coupling, I'm not going to use the lattice model. I'm going to go back to field theory. No, Tianheng is absolutely, that's exactly what I say. Our approximation assumes G going to infinity. We see that, okay, now you can say, for example, can we trust this? For example, suppose n times g squared is 1.1. Is this large g or not for you? G squared times n equal to 1.1. You see, one log of 1.1 is very small. It's almost zero. Then you can indeed take a small, and then it would work. So up to n can we trust? G squared n equal 1.1, is it enough? 1.2? G squared n equal 2? Okay, that would be a bit too big. Up to n can we trust? And this is a hard question. For example, I can tell you that in n equals 4, which is a theory that I know reasonably well, there you also have a toothed coupling, n times g squared. And the n times g squared equal 1/2 is already strong coupling. There, if you plot against the predictions from strong coupling, starting at 1/2, it starts to be very good. What about here? I mean, we don't know. It's hard because this is a complicated theory. But in simpler theories, it's not that irrealistic to say that g squared n equal 1 or 1/2 is already strong coupling. It's not that bad. It gives very good approximations. But okay, let's try to go to strong coupling and see what could k be. Well, k of g has dimensions of mass square, so it must be 1 over a square. It has dimensions of 1 over distance square. So it must be 1 over a square times some function of g. Now, we know that g is renormalized, so there is a beta function for this g, right? This g runs, as you saw, I think, in Michael Peskin's course. And so you saw that in pure glue, the beta function for this coupling g, for the coupling g, which is minus a dg dA, is equal to this famous minus 11 over 48 pi squared n g cubed. Okay? This is what we saw. This was the definition. And this was the result of a perturbative computation of the beta function. And by the way, let me make a side remark about this beta function. So a side remark. So we are claiming that minus a dg dA is equal to minus 11 over 48 pi squared n g cubed. Okay. So let's multiply by g and say that minus a derivative of g squared dA is equal to minus 11 over 48 pi squared n g to the 4, and there is a 2 that I must put somewhere. So when I'm writing this, I'm lying because here I'm getting twice g dg. So I should multiply by 2 before. So here now it's 24. Okay? Now let's multiply by n both. And we have n times g squared. And here n times g squared squared. Okay? So what does it tell you? It tells you that what is the quantity which flows nicely under renormalization? Is it g? No. It's this particular combination, g squared n, which is the toothed coupling. So this is another way of seeing that this planar expansion is what makes sense. Because the quantity that flows nicely is precisely this g squared n, which is lambda, the toothed coupling. So if n is large, it's a bit silly to think of g, because then g under renormalization will scale by a huge n, and it's not natural to think of g as the ornatural parameter. Because then you would start renormalizing, and there would be a huge n, and it would not be the natural scale. So then the thing which scales nicely under renormalization is the toothed coupling. Okay. This was just a side remark. So let's go on. Okay, why am I telling you about the beta function? Because, of course, if we believe that our theory as a good continuum limit, then the something physical, this is physical, and this is not physical, this is just an artifact of our discretization, must be equal to 0. But then we can take the derivative either outside or on G. Right? We can take derivative explicitly with respect to this A or with G through the beta function. And therefore, we get that this 0 is just minus 2 over A cubed times F of G plus 1, okay, minus 1 over A cubed beta of G times F prime of G. Okay, this is just taking derivative with respect to G, derivative of G with respect to A. And this, you find a differential equation for F. And now you solve this differential equation. Okay, and when you solve, you find F, and then you can put it back in K. And you see that K is given by a constant. This you cannot find, because this equation is linear in F. So F multiplied by a constant is still a solution. So this constant you cannot find by this argument. So there is a constant, and then there is a solution, which is exponential of minus 48 pi squared over 11 n g squared. And this is what is k. Okay, very good. You see that n g squared appears here. Appears in a funny way, so this, if you want, is like non-perturbative. If you cannot expand this function in small g square, it has an essential singularity. So it's a non-perturbative effect. Now, this here, as probably Michael Peskin emphasized a lot, this minus is super cool in QCD. This minus came because the beta function had a particular sign. And why is this minus super cool? Because now you see that if you take g to 0, what happens when g is going to 0? This guy is, you can take g to 0 and a to 0, keeping k fixed now. Right? So now, and again, when I say a to 0, I always mean, of course, a times the a over the distance, so that it is something dimensionless. But let me be a bit cavalier. So now, we can take A to 0, G to 0, and K fixed, which is our physical quantity. We fix K, and if you now want to put it in a lattice, okay, I tell you, K is 400 MeV. You will put on a lattice, A equal 1 millimeter, you see what coupling you need to put, and you can mimic my physical K. And notice, this would not work for QED. This would not work for QED because of the wrong sign. And this is something typical. I mean, in QCD, you measure mass of blue balls, you measure lambda QCD, you measure string tensions, you measure dimensionful quantities. And in QED, you measure alpha, you measure G minus 2, you measure dimensionless quantities. This phenomena, what happened here was something funny. We started with G. And by introducing a cutoff, A, we ended up with dimension-full quantities, like K, so also for the mass of the glue balls. Glue balls are just junk of gluons. For mass of the hadrons, of everything. And what is this phenomena? That you start with a dimensionless parameter. By introducing a cutoff, you generate dynamically, in this way, something dimension-full. This is what is called dimensional transmutation. Okay? And it's a very important phenomenon, which, as you see, happens in QCD. And next time, I will start the lecture by showing you a simpler model where we also have dimensional transmutation, which can be seen as a toy model for QCD. So in QCD, as you know very well, K, say the string tension, over say the mass of some glue ball, maybe with some square root here because it has square root dimensions, is equal to a pure number. I mean, there is no G, nothing. I mean, you just, the ratio of these quantities is a number. It's 1.7, 1.45. Okay? And if you want, this is the holy grail of the of quantum field theory. If you want, I mean, this would be the major thing, would be how this would be the ultimate goal, if you want, of solving QCD. So, how to compute this ratio, these pure numbers, which gives something like 1.34, 1.45, or whatever. So you generate mass. You see, if you want, consider two other, let's consider at least approximation order that we are working. This argument did not fix this C, right? So suppose now I consider another quantity which has the same dimensions. Okay, the same argument will give the same thing with a different C. When I make the ratio, everything drops and I get C over C tilde. Right? Just that. And that is something you will measure in an experiment. You will measure mass of the first glue ball, mass of the second glue ball, and you will get 0.8. 0.8 is this ratio, C over C tilde. And this is your goal, this should be our goal to try to come up with useful ways for computing it. And since it is too hard, what people did at some point was try to attack toy models. And this is a big motivation for studying, for example, n equals 4 super n wheels, which is a theory where you can make progress. And you can start answering these kind of questions in a more controlled setting. Other people went to theories. So n equals 4 has some disadvantage with QCD, which is Bessel confinement, for example. It's a theory with lots of differences to QCD. If you want, it's the harmonic oscillator of field theories. And it's the one we should start, but later we can come back to QCD, which is quite tough. Another approach is, no, I really want to keep this dynamical transmutation. I really want to keep more features of QCD. And then another approach, which works very well, and you get lots of intuition, is to study two-dimensional models, which have all these phenomena and so on. And this, for example, is something that you can also do using integrability and integrable models. And I will tell you a bit about some sigma models next time, which exhibit exactly this dimensional transmutation, and which we can understand very explicitly how it works. And okay, I would say for today that is probably it. Okay, any questions? Yes. The low energy what? Yeah, I think so. I think so. Honestly, I think the best hope is ADS-CFT. For